It's always the first thing you see of Grand Marais, Minnesota. No matter what direction you approach this small harbor town of about 1,400 inhabitants, you know you're almost there when you spy a distinctive spit of land stretching into Lake Superior. The Grand Marais Lighthouse extends from the west side of this T-shaped geological feature. The wooded east side forms a small bay called East Bay. Known as Mayhew Point, Coast Guard Point, Grand Marais Point, and even just the Rocks, this landmark is now most commonly referred to as Artist's Point. The thing is, if you're in Grand Marais and refer to the point, people will know what you're talking about. In this edition of WTIP series History Speaks, we tour the point and discover the rich history of the most recognizable section of Grand Marais Harbor. Today, we tend to associate it with being a good place to take a walk. The point's story begins 1.1 million years ago with a lava flow that hardened into rock.
It's called breakwater basalt, so appropriately for the Grand Marais Harbor, because that's exactly what it does, forms that breakwater.
Molly Hoffman has led tours of the Grand Marais Harbor area and was a founding member of Harbor Friends, a nonprofit which worked to both protect the harbor and educate the public about its cultural and natural history.
The other sort of interesting geologic thing is that the structure of having like an island, which is this breakwater basalt, and then the land itself, and having a connection of this gravel, which was formed by the lake, by the wave action of the lake, that's called a tombolo, and it can be between island and island or island and land.
The point's modern history began with the arrival of the Ojibwe or Anishinaabe people from the east sometime in the 1600s. The Anishinaabe reference the point in their place name for what we call Grand Marais.
And the Ojibwe word for that the area, the harbor area, is Kichibatubig, Kichibatubig, which means like double bay.
That's Stacy Drouillard, a Grand Marais native of Grand Marais Chippewa descent. Stacy's master thesis is entitled The Village of Chippewa City and the Grand Marais Chippewa, A Study in Place and Identity, 1850 to 1950.
Grand Marais was a summer village for the Ojibwe people. And so there's lots of evidence that supports that, not just oral history, but historical documents and other research that's been done. And so I think it's a very natural place to have a village. So it would make sense that they would fish out of the harbor.
The Anishinaabe lived a seasonal lifestyle, traveling throughout the region to hunt, fish, collect wild rice, and visit sugar bushes. Rather than settling in the harbor permanently, they would have considered the Grand Marais area one of many Ojibwe places that they visited annually. At the same time, the fur trade had evolved into an established part of Great Lakes culture. Voyagers paddling their large birch bark canoes down Lake Superior's north shore came to know and look for the point. By the early 1800s, the harbor area was being referred to as Grand Marais on Voyager maps.
For the fur traders, it was it's a blinding flash of the obvious. It's a way to, it's a safe place to get off the water, almost with any direction of winds, which is pretty unique on the North Shore. And if you're in a canoe and you've got all your goods that you're trying to live on and sell, the last thing you want to do is get wet when you're getting off. So good harborage was known. That was the information that was passed along.
Tim Cochran is the superintendent at Grand Portage National Monument. He recently completed a manuscript about the American Fur Company's trading posts in the Grand Marais Harbor.
Well, in the absence of any real good evidence, any documentary evidence or buildings or, you know, old cribbings, I guess, it doesn't look like there's much. But in the 1820s in particular and 1830s, the American Fur Company was actually more in Grand Marais than not in that period of time.
The American Fur Company had two outposts in the Grand Marais Harbor area. They established the first outpost in the early 1820s.
So they were really, really hoping that fishing was going to be just knocked dead wonderful. And it was for the fall. The winter was a different matter. So they're looking for a place where they can eat, find something to eat. But then they're also looking for a place where essentially it's convenient for Indians and Anishinaabe people to be traveling by, through, or near. As it turned out, Grand Marais turned out not to be a great spot for moving into the inland. It's just too long of a haul. The traditional way to get into the, you know, interior in this part of the world was to go to Grand Portage, take the Portage, and go up the Pigeon River.
The residents of that first outpost found trade slow and food lacking. After several years of struggling to survive, they eventually abandoned the outpost. Then, in the late 1830s and early 1840s, the American Fur Company returned to attempt a fishing operation out of the Grand Marais Harbor. But this time, abundance spelled their downfall.
They had a real problem. They were catching too many fish, and they didn't have a market. They were too far away from people who could buy fish.
By the mid-1840s, the American Fur Company had moved on, and any changes they had made to the harbor landscape quickly disappeared. But there were many white settlers who wanted to challenge the voyageurs' conclusion that Grand Marais was inhospitable and too far from inland lakes to be a good outpost. Local historian Willis Raff called these men pioneers in the wilderness, and they were convinced that Grand Marais was their gateway to riches. When the 1854 Treaty of La Pointe opened Grand Marais to white settlement, they could hardly wait to move in.
In Will Raff's book, there's an account of men in boats sitting out in the harbor waiting for news of the treaty signing so that they could officially come on shore and start their mining exploration and the other, you know, land claims and things like that.
Henry Mayhew, Sam Howenstein, Ted Wakelin, and others had big dreams for Grand Marais.
The dream being commercial docks, and that the mine up at Gunflint was going to be very successful, and there was going to be a railroad line to deliver all that, and Grand Marais was going to be like Duluth with the highest per capita millionaires around.
Henry Mayhew, in particular, had high hopes for the prospecting he was doing inland, along what we know today as the Gunflint Trail.
That harbor was important to them because of the shipping. I mean, his mind was in a different place. He wasn't looking at the fish. The fishermen were hauling in a lot of fish, but he was out to create that trade business and did so successfully, and that's why the town became established where it did.
The natural harbor created by the point provided Mayhew with a perfect location for his commercial docks. But first, he needed to acquire ownership of the point.
What we now know as the point or Artist Point was an Indian allotment as part of the Treaty of 1854. And the document that that first talks about that shows that it was allotted to a man whose last name was Russo, and it quickly changed hands to someone in the Morrison family. And then I believe it was sold or traded to the Mayhew Wakelin land company that whose name you see on a lot of documents from back then.
Mayhew was anxious to build up his commercial docks, but a late season shipping tragedy exposed the perils of the natural harbor. Jim Shinners is a local shipwreck researcher.
We do not actually have a safe harbor. It does offer protection, but that protection tends to be for winds out of the northeast, north, northwest.
On December 12, 1875, the Stranger, a 60-foot trading schooner loaded with supplies for Grand Marais, came into the harbor as a storm from the west came up. There were four men on board.
So it was determined by Captain Clark that he needed to get out of the harbor, or he would have been washed ashore, actually, on what we currently, today, is the breakwater. Captain Clark attempted to round what at that time was a point. There was no lighthouse there and no breakwater. And on the other side of the point, the Stranger struck rocks, and with winds from the west, it capsized. George Coburn went into the water when the Stranger capsized, and he drowned in short order. You can imagine the water temperature that time of the year. The captain and two remaining crewmen grabbed axes, and they were able to cut off the two masts and cut loose any of the other rigging, and the schooner righted herself. Unfortunately, under the circumstances, that exposed the Stranger to very strong west winds, and as the schooner was drifting offshore, waves got greater and greater.
Grand Marais residents watched the disaster unfold, and six Grand Marais men launched a small fishing boat and rowed out in the high sea to attempt to rescue the Stranger's crew.
The fishing boat was actually able to get alongside the Stranger, but the crew were already suffering. These days we would call it hypothermia. At that time it was exposure, and they were unable to grasp any of the lines that were heaved over to them. By this time, too, they were far enough offshore that conditions prohibited any of the crew from boarding the Stranger. And I'm sure at some point here, the crew of this fishing boat are thinking about the need to pull back toward shore into an incredibly strong wind in sub-zero temperatures. So with a great deal of regret, they had to abandon the Stranger and turn back toward shore.
The Stranger and its crew drifted to sea and was never heard from again. Traumatized by the Stranger disaster, town officials decided steps must be taken to make the harbor safer. They began construction of a breakwall, and in 1885, the first lighthouse was built. In the 30 years since the Treaty of La Pointe, Grand Marais had been transformed into a busy harbor village. The Treaty of La Pointe was just the first of many U.S. government measures that drastically changed how the Anishinaabe used the Grand Marais Harbor.
I think a lot of the construction of the breakwall and the harbor construction and the harbor project employed a lot of local Anishinaabe people. People came from the various villages to work there. In a large part, the village of Chippewa City, which was about a half mile east of Grand Marais proper, where the St. Francis Xavier Church is now, that was once a large Chippewa village. And many of the people who lived there, especially at the turn of the century in the late 1890s, were living there because they were working on the harbor project.
While town officials worked to make the harbor safer, they also wanted to make the harbor more hospitable to industry and commerce. Ed Humphrey was a Grand Marais city councilman for 20 years in the mid-20th century and shared his memories in a 2002 interview with the Cook County Historical Society. While serving on a planning committee, he discovered early plans for the town of Grand Marais.
And they dug up the history of this. There was, in about the turn of the century, this was going to be a great country here. They were going to build an ore dock on East Bay, you know.
Yeah.
And so they laid out the city of Grand Marais going to be 5,000 people. Mm-hmm. And Broadway was the big main street that went right up the hill.
Yeah.
They had blueprints on all that. 1897, they were going to make a harbor at Grand Marais.
Yes.
They'd already built the breakwater, but there was just a bunch of weeds in there. And they had Whitney Brothers from Duluth
mm-hmm.
come and dredge it out.
Yes.
And every year they would run the dredge up here and then load out gravel
mm-hmm.
for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they took all that gravel to Duluth and sold us.
The dredging operation drastically changed the harbor landscape that the early Anishinaabe and voyageurs had known.
I mean, they were going after it because they wanted to have a deep harbor for this industrial activity, which they assumed was happening, and the business people were supporting it, and so. But the Corps of Engineers did not stop or slow down for many, many years. They kept shooting for 16-foot depth all over the harbor. The depth of the harbor initially was very shallow. It was a very shallow, nice harbor, great for canoes and for, you know, stuff like that. But that, I think people are surprised because there's a 6-acre chunk of the harbor that used to be, well, it used to be land, and now it's harbor, and that's in front of the trading post, the Lake Superior Trading Post. That corner there is... In fact, there's old pictures at the museum of baseball games being played there.
Town officials could control the harbor environment to a certain extent, but the community was always facing threats outside of human control. Several scary experiences with wildfires in the early days of Grand Marais led to the construction of one of the point's oddest features. In 1928, a fire tower was erected atop the basalt rock face on the west side of the point in a location almost completely surrounded by water. Even 20 years later, the town was still spooked by the experience of the 1908 wildfires. Pat Zankman is the former director of the Cook County Historical Society.
And those big forest fires, there were a whole bunch of them, and they started on the other side of Duluth, and they went all the way to Thunder Bay. And in the case, they burned part of Tofty. The church had just been built. That was burnt in Tofty. They burnt part of Maple Hill. You know where the cemetery is, the Maple Hill Cemetery? You could probably see Lake Superior from there at that point. And this is called Pincushion Mountain because it was burnt over. And that's all there was there. But the fire went all the way on up, and people were evacuated. They did expect Grand Marais to burn. It had been, they had lost power. There was a little wireless station here, and they had gone off the air because everybody was pretty much down ready to evacuate. And so the Minneapolis and Chicago papers indicate that Grand Marais has probably burned. Nothing has been heard from.
Along with the lighthouse and fire tower, the Coast Guard also set up shop on the point in 1928 to provide the community with more protection.
The Coast Guard station could not see over that lump that is Artist Point. And so because apparently the radio service still wasn't trustworthy enough, they had to build this tower and have it manned all during the shipping season to physically see what was happening. And
improved radio communications soon made both the fire and Coast Guard towers obsolete. In 1945, the towers were disassembled, although their footings remain visible today. The point not only provided Grand Marais with industry and protection, it also contributed to the town's growing tourist trade. Ella Mayhew Townsend was the great-niece of Henry Mayhew. Her father, Joseph Mayhew, was the first lighthouse keeper in Grand Marais, and he ran a souvenir shop for tourists.
Tourists used to come up on the boat, passenger boat, the Dixon and the America that came from Duluth. They stayed at the boarding house. There were no cabins of any kind. Some of them had put up tents, and many of them came here to go out into the woods and take up land, and others just came for a rest, a real rest, and they enjoyed the beaches and the points especially. The favorite thing to do was to go for long walks. Father used to take them over to see the lighthouse. We had many, many people from the University of Minnesota. There was a Professor Hibbert, the university photographer, that came up here and took many pictures. Professor McMillan, who was a professor of botany, came to Grand Marais, made this his headquarters, and went out into the woods from here for specimens.
Many of those early tourists left a permanent mark on the point when they chiseled their names and the dates of their visits on the basalt rock leading out to the lighthouse.
I could picture people and families doing their picnics out there waiting for their relatives to come in on a nice day. I can picture some of the seamen having a good chisel and a hammer and doing a really good job. Those are some of the best. They're deeply chiseled into the rock.
Roads were slow in reaching Grand Marais, and well into the 20th century, steamboats such as the America, Dixon, and Winya remained Grand Marais' link to the outside world, delivering mail, supplies, and passengers at the docks on the point. In a 1999 interview with the Cook County Historical Society, old-timer Ted Johnson remembers the America steamboat.
But when we came in town, of course, mm-hmm. everybody had to go on a see the boat, and they'd go aboard, and it blew the whistle, you know, when it was coming to town, and then everybody would have to go down and mm-hmm. see the boat. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'd meet somebody that they were waiting for, and mm-hmm. they get stuff that they were waiting to get that's coming on a boat, you know.
One steamboat in particular, the Winya, had a permanent impact on the point.
It seemed like the Winya captain was not a shy man. And the problem is, okay, they built the breakwaters, but you couldn't walk on them. There was not a sidewalk. These were not capped at first. They were just retained by wood, all this stuff. And so that there was no way to walk. The lighthouse keeper had to use a boat to get out there. And in 1937, after much complaint by the captain of the Winya, because what happened is the water was coming in these gaps, and he said that loading was very dangerous. It was very difficult for him to load and unload his boat in that, if there was any high water, high waves at all. So finally, in 1937, the government went out there, and they capped the whole thing and filled in the gaps, and that's why you could walk out there.
Today, the large steamboats are long gone. Now, small fishing and pleasure boats primarily use the harbor. Air patrol and sophisticated radio communication protect the town from the threat of wildfire. Over the years, the Coast Guard's presence on the point has diminished. All that remains of Mayhew's docks are a few timbers tucked into a wooded area west of the old Coast Guard station, and any industrial use of the area ceased in the early 1980s when Consolidated Paper stopped using the harbor and the point for its timber operation. Although the name and use of the point continues to change and evolve, it seems that the point will always be the heart of the Grand Marais community. When you walk on the point, you walk in the footsteps of countless people who have come to this small piece of land throughout the centuries, seeking protection, subsistence, beauty, and more. Stacy Drouillard.
I just think it's important to remember that there's a lot of history there, and it's been a very important place to a lot of people for a very long time, and to tread lightly on it.
History Speaks is supported by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, which supports arts, cultural, and history features on WTIP. This documentary was produced by Ada Igo with assistance from WTIP staff members. Special thanks to the Cook County Historical Society for research assistance and the use of their oral history archives.